The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of the Katra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. We've got quite a topic today. We're diving into Simon Critchley's introduction to continental philosophy. Now, I know for a lot of you listening, hearing continental philosophy might sound, well, intimidating, dense, maybe.
Yeah, it definitely has that reputation, doesn't it? But that's precisely why Critchley's book is so important and kind of the mission for us today. We want to get under the skin of how this whole philosophical tradition, and it spans centuries of massive change, tries to tackle the big, messy crises of being modern.
Okay, but you know, philosophy often gets tagged as just abstract thinking, maybe a bit detached. How does Critchley convince us right away that this isn't just academics talking to academics?
Well, he frames it around this really central, urgent question. He asks, look, the old anchors for meaning, maybe God, maybe absolute reason, maybe some fixed human nature, they've kind of lost their grip, right? So in that world, how do we find meaning? Or maybe more accurately, how do we create it? How do we live authentically, freely? And why it matters now is because, as Critchley really hammers home, the gap between what we know, I mean, our incredible science, our technical power, and how we should live, you know, wisdom, ethics, that gap feels wider than ever.
That distinction, knowing versus living.
Yeah, that hits home. Let's maybe unpack Critchley himself for a moment, because he seems like a really good guide for this kind of journey. He's Simon Critchley, an English philosopher, quite prominent, and he's the Hans Jonas professor at the New School in New York. Right, and the New School connection is actually quite significant. It's known globally as this major center for continental thought, especially in the U.S. So he's right in the thick of it. But his authority isn't just, you know, pure academic credentials, so he definitely has those. He engages deeply with the really tough figures like Heidegger, like Derrida.
But he's more than just an academic analyst, isn't he? The sources say he's kind of a bridge builder.
Exactly. He's a fantastic communicator. He writes with real clarity, even some wit, and this sense of urgency that you don't always find. He's writing for a broader audience, not just specialists. He's not just dusting off old books.
So he's an active participant.
Very much so. He's arguing that this tradition is alive, it's ongoing. He wants to show that continental philosophy is still a vital toolkit for understanding our world and, crucially, for thinking about how we might change it. It's not just history, it's got tools for today.
Okay, so let's talk about the book itself then. Its purpose. You said it's not just a list of famous philosophers.
No, definitely not. He sets it up more like a narrative designed to make the whole field less mystifying, especially if you're new to it.
Yeah.
He really focuses on two key ideas, critique and transformation.
Critique and transformation. Okay.
Yeah. He sees continental philosophy as this long, evolving conversation trying to diagnose what's gone wrong in modernity, things like alienation, nihilism, that feeling of meaninglessness. Mm-hmm. And he puts a lot of emphasis on praxis.
Praxis. That's the idea that philosophy isn't just about thinking, it's about doing.
Precisely. The idea that the ultimate point isn't just to understand the world, but to actually engage with it, maybe even change it for the better.
Yeah.
It's philosophy with its sleeves rolled up.
So if it's this ongoing conversation, this narrative, where does Critchley start the story? What's the arc?
He traces the fuse back to Immanuel Kant, back in the 18th century. Kant, maybe without fully intending to, kind of set the stage for the whole crisis.
Yeah.
He famously drew this line between theoretical reason, what science can know, and practical reason, what we ought to do, morality.
Ah, okay. The things we can prove versus the things we should value.
Exactly. And Critchley argues that pretty much the entire continental tradition that follows is, in one way or another, trying to wrestle with that gap, trying to bridge it because it feels dangerous, unstable.
So Kant creates this split. Who's the first major figure Critchley presents as trying to sort of heal that division?
That would be the big one, Hegel. Mm-hmm. And his whole movement, German idealism. Hegel is just monumental. He tried to overcome Kant's divisions by arguing that reality isn't static. It's this dynamic unfolding of what he called spirit or Geist. Think of it like the collective human consciousness, culture, history, gradually coming to understand itself.
And he uses the dialectic to explain that process, right?
Yes, the dialectic is key. It's this engine of progress through conflict and resolution. The classic example everyone knows is the master-slave dialectic.
Why is that specific example still so resonant?
Because it's fundamentally about the struggle for recognition. Hegel shows that we only really become fully self-aware, fully human, when another free consciousness acknowledges us as such. Think about it, that connects directly to basically every modern fight for rights, for identity, for social justice. It's all, in a way, a struggle for mutual recognition.
But Hegel's attempt to create this grand, all-explaining system, well, it didn't exactly satisfy everyone, did it? It kind of broke apart.
Oh, dramatically. Critchley calls them Hegel's ungrateful heirs. You get this major split. On one side, you've got Karl Marx focusing intensely on politics and economics.
Right, the material world.
Exactly. Marx flips Hegel on his head. Forget abstract spirit, he says. It's material conditions, how we work, who owns what, the economy that drives history. He gives us this powerful critique of alienation.
That feeling of being disconnected from your work, from what you produce, even from other people under capitalism.
Precisely. It's that estrangement. And for Marx, philosophy isn't enough if it just observes. His famous line, philosophers have hitherto only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it.
Okay, so that's one direction, the systemic material critique. What about the other side of the split?
That's where you get the champions of the individual, the subjective experience. Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. They both reacted against Hegel's massive impersonal system.
They wanted to focus on the person, the passion.
Absolutely. Kierkegaard, often called the first existentialist, emphasized subjective truth, the personal commitment, the famous leap of faith in the face of uncertainty. Then Nietzsche comes along, even more radical, declares the death of God, meaning the collapse of traditional values, and demands that we become creators of new values, the Übermensch.
Wow. So you have this tension, change the system versus change yourself, find meaning in collective struggle versus find it in radical individual choice. That feels like it sets the stage for the 20th century.
It absolutely does. And when Critchley moves into the 20th century, the critique sharpens, focusing especially on technology and the nature of reason itself.
You mean like how reason can go wrong?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Think about the Frankfurt School Adorno, Horkheimer. They were writing in the shadow of World War II and the Holocaust, asking this terrifying question. How did the Enlightenment, which promised liberation through reason, end up leading to fascism?
That's a heavy question. What was their answer?
They argued that reason itself had become distorted. It became instrumental reason, purely focused on efficiency, calculation, control, domination, rather than human emancipation or understanding.
And that connects to their idea of the culture industry, right? Mass media consumerism.
Yes. They argued it pacifies us, makes us conformist. It sort of neutralizes critical thought by churning out standardized entertainment and desires. Efficiency becomes the main value, not human well-being.
Okay, that's one major critique. And then Critchley brings in Heidegger, who offers a different, but maybe related, warning.
Very different angle, but yes, also a deep critique of modernity. Heidegger talked about our forgetfulness of being. He was worried that modern technology, techno, wasn't just a set of tools, but a way of seeing the entire world.
How so? What way of seeing?
It's just raw material, resources to be managed, ordered, exploited. He called it the standing reserve, or B-stand. He feared we start seeing everything, forests, rivers, animals, even other humans, as just things waiting to be optimized.
Now, with Heidegger, Critchley has to address the elephant in the room, his Nazism. That's a massive ethical problem when using his ideas. How does the book handle that?
Critchley confronts it directly. He doesn't shy away from the biographical facts and the political failings. But he argues that despite the philosopher's personal actions, the philosophical concepts like B-stand might still be indispensable tools for diagnosing our technological condition. It's a difficult balance, but the idea is to separate the tool from the person where possible, critically.
That concept of standing reserve, you can see that applied in so many places today, like in corporate environments sometimes.
Absolutely. It's a powerful lens. Okay, so after the war, Critchley moves to the explosion of thought in France. Post-war Paris.
Existentialism comes roaring back with Sartre.
Right. Sartre and his famous line, existence precedes essence. Basically, we're born without a predefined purpose or nature. We just exist first, and then through our choices, our actions, we create who we are, our essence.
Which sounds incredibly freeing. But also puts immense pressure on us. Radical freedom means radical responsibility, no excuses.
Exactly. You're condemned to be free, as he put it. Then, building on, but also moving beyond existentialism, you get the post-structuralists. Foucault is huge here.
Foucault and power, but not just kings and governments, right?
No, much more pervasive. He analyzed how institutions, prisons, hospitals, schools, use what he called power knowledge to shape and control individuals. It's not just about saying no, it's about defining what's normal, what's healthy, what's acceptable, thereby producing the very subjects it governs.
Okay, shaping us from the inside out almost. And the last big French figure Critchley tackles is Derrida and deconstruction. This one often sounds the most abstract.
It can sound that way. Critchley tries to make it practical. Think of deconstruction as a method of reading, of analysis. It looks closely at texts, philosophical texts, but really any text to show how seemingly stable concepts, especially binary oppositions like good devil, man, woman, speech writing, are built on shaky ground.
How they depend on each other, and one is usually subtly privileged over the other.
Exactly. It reveals the hidden assumptions, the instability in language and thought itself. The point isn't just to tear things down, but to show that meaning is more fluid, more contested, than we often assume.
Okay, that's a whirlwind tour through some heavy hitters.
Mm-hmm.
After taking us on this journey, what are the main takeaways, the sort of unifying threads Critchley wants us to see in this whole continental tradition?
Well, the first one, which we've touched on a few times, is definitely philosophy as critique and transformation. The core idea isn't just understanding for understanding's sake. It's philosophy as an active practice, a way to critically engage with the world and potentially change it.
Yeah, that prompts you to ask, doesn't it? What things in my own life, my work, my culture, do I just accept as the way things are? Applying that critical lens can really open up new ways of thinking.
Absolutely. The second big theme is the crisis of modernity and the search for meaning.
Mm.
This whole tradition is really defined by how it grapples with nihilism. That sense that maybe there's no ultimate meaning or value handed down to us.
And the answer isn't usually finding some hidden truth, is it?
Not usually, no.
Yeah.
It's more about suggesting that meaning has to be created, forged through our choices, our actions, our commitments, our relationships. It's something we build, not something we discover.
Okay, and the third theme, you mentioned instrumental reason earlier.
Yes, the critique of instrumental reason. This is the warning, coming strongly from folks like the Frankfurt School and Heidegger, against letting reason become purely about calculation, efficiency, and control, detached from ethics or human flourishing.
We see that everywhere, don't we? When systems or technologies designed to help end up dehumanizing the process.
All the time. It makes you ask, is this process, this technology, this metric, actually serving human goals? Or are we ending up serving the process itself? That's the core of that critique. Vital for today.
Critchley's book must have some really memorable ways of summing these complex ideas up. Can we share a few key paraphrase statements that capture the essence?
Definitely. Critchley is good at crystallizing things. Here's one idea he emphasizes. The core problem animating continental philosophy is not that we lack scientific knowledge, but that this explosion of knowledge has failed to make us any wiser about how to live.
That really hits on the knowledge-wisdom gap you mentioned at the start. We know how to do so much, but not why or whether we should.
Exactly. Here's another key idea, reflecting that critical impulse. Continental philosophy is a tradition of unmasking or demystification. It seeks to show that the things we take for granted as natural or eternal, like human nature, justice, or even reason itself, are in fact historical constructions that serve specific interests.
That's the challenge, to see things not as fixed, but as things that have been built, often to benefit someone. It's a powerful, if sometimes unsettling, idea.
It is. And it links to a third core thought, maybe drawing implicitly from figures like Levinas, who emphasize ethics. The ethical relationship with the other person often precedes and makes possible all our other ways of knowing the world.
So relating to others ethically isn't just one part of philosophy. It might be the very foundation.
That's a strong current within the tradition, yes. Ethics isn't just an afterthought.
What's great about Critchley's approach is that he doesn't just leave you with theory. He frames it as a practical toolkit. So how can listeners actually use these ideas?
Okay, application one, existential ownership. Think Kierkegaard, think Sartre. That idea, existence precedes essence. When you're facing a big life choice, career, relationship, whatever, remember, there's no cosmic script. You're condemned to be free.
So you define yourself through your actions. It's on you. That sounds daunting, but also empowering.
It can be really empowering. You get to write your own definition. Application two, media literacy, drawing from Foucault or deconstruction. When you encounter news, political speech, advertising, don't just consume it passively.
Look deeper.
Yeah. Ask. What's not being said, what assumptions are being made, question those simple binaries, us versus them, good versus evil. How is this language trying to shape my view, maybe maintain a certain power dynamic? It's a critical thinking tool for everyday life.
And a third one, maybe bringing it back to the workplace.
Right. Workplace critique, using the Frankfurt School or Heidegger. Apply that critique of instrumental reason. Look at things like performance metrics, efficiency drives, best practices. Ask, are these genuinely helping people flourish and do good work?
Or are they maybe subtle forms of control? Foucault style, that reduce people to resources that Beistand Heidegger warned about.
Exactly. It gives you a different language, a different lens for understanding organizational life, and maybe even pushing back a little.
So, wrapping up, what's the final big takeaway you get from Critchley's presentation of this tradition?
For me, the lasting insight is that philosophy, in this continental vein, isn't really something you just learn, like memorizing dates. It's something you do. It's a continuous practice. It requires ongoing critical thinking about yourself and society. And maybe the struggle itself, wrestling with these big questions about meaning, freedom, justice, and maybe that struggle is a meaningful human activity in itself.
Yeah, I agree. What struck me most and what I loved about the work Critchley presents it is how he manages to pull a coherent, urgent conversation out of what can seem like a really disparate, complex, frankly confusing field. He makes this compelling case that this deep conversation about how to live freely and authentically in a challenging world, well, it's never been more relevant than it is right now. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.